news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all to the Micah Hanks program. I am your host, glad to be here and getting into gear with you guys as we go in pursuit of the enigmatic as we do every week. And of course, we have a lot on our minds tonight, which include something rather unusual that was seen right here in the old North State. Down on the East End, this was weird, even for a guy like me who watches an awful lot of natural phenomena, including those kinds that lurk in your backyard and raid my trash can every summer. More on that in a moment. Also, a mass fossil site in southern Utah that's changing our perspective about the paleontological past. And of course, some Mars updates, because yes, we have had liftoff on the red planet. And more in the way of science, in addition to a few emails from you guys as well. We got a lot of response to last week's episode that usually happens when we talk about UFO news on this program. But on the subject of UFOs, Larry Hancock will be joining us to discuss the national intelligence perspective on UFOs. What a deep dive into the study of documents that have been released by the U.S. government on that subject over the years actually tell us about the UFO phenomena, you know, how important it is and how it has been observed by and assessed by various intelligence agencies, what it may mean to them today. And also some of the shortcomings as far as the government's role in UFO studies over the years. I think there's certainly some room for improvement. Talking with Larry will no doubt help to illustrate that point even more vividly. And so I'm really looking forward to diving into that with him and having a good lengthy conversation about national intelligence matters as it relates to UFOs. But I hope you guys all had a wonderful weekend out there. You know, I turned 38 on Saturday, and celebrating my birthday, it was a little unconventional. I didn't necessarily get out there. I told ex-subscribers over the weekend a little about this. It wasn't a huge party for me this year. No, I was invited to go and play a show with my banjo player extraordinaire, Charles Wood. We hadn't performed any together this year, and we only played a few times last year. And it was a strange and almost surreal feeling to be able to be around people. Everyone was still social distancing. It was a very small group, but it was a wedding up around Cashers, North Carolina, and it was so nice to drive further than 30 minutes from my house. I mean, really, that has been the norm for the pandemic. A lot less travel, a lot less getting out there on the road, seeing the beautiful countryside, certainly very little interaction with people in public settings. You know, things are starting to feel ever so slightly normal again, aren't they? At least for some of us. And we've got a ways to go as far as the pandemic and everything, but I mean, I'm sincerely hoping that we will begin to start feeling more normal like that. It certainly felt normal for me. And so I thought, well, how better to celebrate my birthday? You know, than be up there in the beautiful mountains playing a guitar? Come on, that was great. I have absolutely no complaints. Well, yeah, actually, I guess I have one. One of the things that I love about driving down toward the Georgia border, this is a place where the guys and I often perform when we go travel and play for various weddings and other events and things. Yeah, one of the things I do look forward to is seeing wildlife, because it's not uncommon to see deer or turkeys or even bear out there when you're driving, especially in the early morning or right after sundown. Well, on Saturday, I didn't get to see any of that. But you do see plenty around here. In fact, if anything, I think I've seen more black bears in western North Carolina in recent years than I have ever at any time in my life. And I don't have to travel to see them. I've got photos of them in the yard across the street from my house. And of course, I attempted to photograph the massive black bear that raided my trash can last summer, but it was too dark. I was able to see him just fine with my eyes, but the lens of my camera had a little harder time visualizing the great big black bear with his back to me as he lumbered away when I told him, "Get out of my trash can." But a few observers down on the east end of North Carolina over the weekend, they saw something a little more unusual than the average black bear sighting. In fact, what they saw, they might have thought at first it was Bigfoot. I'm looking at photographs right now, and I'll have this linked in the show notes for you. They took photos of a black bear standing up on its hind legs, And the couple who saw it said when they saw this bear, he was just standing there, perfectly straight up on his hind legs. And then at one point he turns and looks in their direction, and they said, "We thought it was a guy in a suit." And, I mean, if I had been the one taking the photograph, I might have thought the same thing initially. But sure enough, this black bear was standing there on his hind legs, perfectly upright, like a guy in a suit, just looking around. And Aaron McAllister, one of the photographers, said it was standing so still and stoically. We had both never seen black bears in the wild before, but my boyfriend could tell right away that the bear in that standing position seemed kind of unnatural and odd. It stood in that position for close to 10 minutes, they said. Now, what's even stranger than a black bear standing upright for 10 minutes and just looking around, like they said this one did, which, again, is not the kind of thing that you often see with black bears, but they certainly can do it. No, what's even stranger is when you see black bears walking on their hind legs. A few years ago, there was a video circulating of a black bear that had injured one of its forepaws and had a hard time walking, and so this bear just adapted to walking on his hind legs. And it was the funniest thing because with those short, stubby legs, as he comes walking along, the first thing that comes to mind is Yogi Bear. Here comes Yogi Bear. But in one of the clips of this black bear that had adapted to moving bipedally, you actually are unable to see his upper torso and head. All you see is the furry legs and the lower torso walking along. And I mean, for a moment, you would actually think, okay, here comes Sasquatch. This is it. Sighting of the century. And then once he comes out from behind the brush, you see the black bear head looking around, much like the one in the photograph there, featured at the Charlotte Observer over the weekend. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they say that in the area of Union County, North Carolina, where this couple photographed this bear standing there looking around, that there are roughly 4 bears per square mile. A refuge area, it has a total of 63,896 acres, so think about that. 4 bears per square mile, that is a lot of black bears. No wonder we're seeing so many of them up here in North Carolina. But heading further west, you know, there's a recent discovery at a fossil site that is causing some people to really question what we think we know about Tyrannosaurus rex. In King County, according to KSL.com, a mass tyrannosaur death site discovered in southern Utah, they say, is maybe providing enough evidence now to prove an emerging theory about how Tyrannosaurus lived millions of years ago. What they essentially think is that these creatures hunted in packs rather than as lone predators. Now, if you thought that one Tyrannosaurus rex was scary enough, imagine being pursued by a pack of them. A pack of ravenous dinosaurs. According to the findings, which were published today in the journal Peer J, the authors call this the latest evidence that seems to help conclude that Tyrannosaurus were actually social carnivores, kind of like wolves, and less like the solitary predators as they had been believed and depicted to be in the past. I'm always fascinated by the idea that some of these ancient, massive predators could have behaved a lot more socially than we would imagine. And again, for me, you know, it always comes back to Sasquatch, because I'm unapologetic about my love for that subject. This is the very reason why I launched the supplemental podcast Sasquatch Tracks. Amazing how many people actually still haven't picked up on the fact that I do another podcast. I actually do 4 of them right now. And so you'll want to check out the webpage, MicahHanks.com/shows. That's where all my podcasts can be found. But of course, MicahHanks.com/podcast is the page for this show and all the episodes of it. So in fact, if you really want to find the show I'm talking about, go over to SasquatchTracks.com. That's where that can be found. But I bring that up again, especially in relation to the funny story about the black bear we just told, because when we look at ancient creatures like Tyrannosaurus and how we are beginning to learn new things about them, I can't help but wonder about the more speculative side of zoology and creatures like Bigfoot. You know, Bigfoot, if it exists, and that's still a big if with the absence of their presence in either the fossil record or in terms of physical evidence of living creatures today. But it is often speculated that these creatures, because they're only usually seen one at a time, that they are solitary. But fortunately, they're not predators. Again, I would think if they were predators like T-Rex, it would be much harder for them to have remained hidden. And so if a creature like Sasquatch does exist, they are probably following subsistence patterns that help them to remain isolated and undiscoverable. I mean, it stands to reason that if these things were ravenous creatures that were hunting down prey, I would think you'd be more likely to see them, because they'd be taking more chances in the way that they obtain food. that would be making more of an impact on existing wildlife populations, something that biologists would have to notice. But on the other side of that equation, you know, I've talked to biologists who have said, try and find a black bear carcass. Try and find any evidence of grizzly bears in the Pacific Northwest. I talked with David George Gordon a while back on the very first episode of the Sasquatch Tracks podcast, and one of the things that David said, he's a naturalist, by the way, and he said there was a study done a number of years ago where U.S. Fish and Wildlife was trying to log the presence of grizzly bears up there in the Northwest, and he says, you know how many grizzly bears they actually found evidence of outside of a few footprints? None. He says, we know they're there, but they weren't able to log the presence of any of them apart from a few footprints. And he says, this is an animal species that we know exists. We know that there are populations of them. This is a large animal species, and at times a rather scary one. And yet, despite knowing that they are there and knowing where to go and look for them, presumably, scientists had a tremendously difficult time actually tracking them down. And so David George Gordon, who I think is also on the fence about Sasquatch, but like me is very interested in it, he said, if we want to presume that a large animal, and presumably one that is more intelligent than the average bear, quite literally, if we wanted to presume that such a creature could exist, it may not be impossible that they could actually remain very, very elusive, because plenty of other animals that perhaps are not as intelligent as we would expect Sasquatch to be, seem to be able to do the same thing. And in fact, I'm kind of glad that they remain elusive. I'm especially glad that they don't hunt in packs. That would maybe be terrifying. But I'll tell you what was really exciting, not terrifying, but certainly exhilarating, was the fact that we had liftoff on the Red Planet. That's right, we have flown the first aircraft on Mars. According to the Washington Post, NASA successfully flew its 4-pound helicopter from the surface of Mars early today. The first powered flight of an aircraft on another planet. Well, at least that we know of. And this, a feat that NASA officials compared to the Wright brothers' first flight here in the Old North State back in 1903. The flight took place at the early hour of 3:30 a.m. as the twin carbon fiber rotor blades on Ingenuity began spinning furiously, and then the chopper, they said, lifted off the surface of the Red Planet, reaching an altitude of just about 10 feet, where it then hovered, turned, and landed softly in an autonomous flight that lasted just 30 seconds. Didn't take much to make history, but Ingenuity indeed was able to lift off, hover, and land. That's really all you need for a helicopter to do, right? Although, of course, they hope to do more with it. They're hoping that they can actually use Ingenuity to do a little bit of recon up there on the Red Planet, spot objects on the ground or areas that might be worthy of investigation, maybe even good landing sites for future rovers. According to the WashPo, inside the Flight Operations Center at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, engineers broke into applause when confirmation of the flight arrived in a data burst that took about 3 hours to travel the 178 million miles from Mars to Earth. And that's another thing to keep in mind. If it seems a little underwhelming that a helicopter lifted off, hovered 10 feet off the ground, and touched back down, totaling about 30 seconds of flight, you got to remember that this is being carried out by engineers out there at JPL in California from 178 million miles away. That's really impressive, all things considered. But of course, as we are getting the hang of flying Ingenuity and, of course, controlling all the other operations we have going on up there on the Red Planet, it is our hope that we will continue to find compelling data that will help to flesh out the picture of how Mars once looked and, of course, what might still be going on there in the here and now. But Ingenuity and Perseverance aren't the only things that have NASA excited because, you know, we also had an earlier space mission reach a new milestone. And heading over here to NASA.gov, according to a press release, they say in the weeks following its launch in early 2006, when NASA's New Horizons was still close to home, it took just minutes to transmit a command to the spacecraft and hear back that the onboard computer received and was ready to carry out the instructions. But, they say, as New Horizons crossed the solar system and its distance from Earth jumped from millions to billions of miles, that time between contacts grew from a few minutes to several hours. Well, on Saturday, while your friendly neighborhood podcaster was up in the mountains, New Horizons was reaching what they call a rare deep space milepost, 50 astronomical units from the sun, or, that is, 50 times further from the sun than Earth is. That puts New Horizons billions of miles away from our planet and just the fifth spacecraft of its kind to reach such a great distance, following, of course, the legendary Voyagers 1 and 2, and also their predecessors, Pioneers 10 and 11. So New Horizons right now is about 5 billion miles away, a remote region, according to NASA, where one of those radioed commands, even traveling at the speed of light, would still need 7 hours to reach the far-flung spacecraft. But they say add 7 more hours before its control team on Earth finds out if the message was even received. So round trip, you're looking at 14 hours. And yet we're still able to communicate with these spacecraft over such incredible distances. Science knows no limits, ladies and gents. And further proof of that came with the cracking of the proverbial code of another mystery, and I mean no pun when I say cracking, because what we're talking about here is a long-standing mystery in science known as the Brazil nut effect. I'm not kidding, quit laughing. No, seriously, have you ever bought a can of mixed nuts? And you open it and you'll see a lot of the larger nuts, pecans, but especially those Brazil nuts, right there at the top. And as silly as this sounds, this is actually a recognized phenomenon. I mean, it happens with a lot of different things, but the so-called Brazil nut effect is the name given to this. Why are the Brazil nuts always on top? Is that because they're put in the can last? No, actually, there is a whole phenomena that explains this. And in fact, according to a team of scientists from the University of Manchester in England, they have captured the complicated dynamics that cause the mysterious Brazil nut effect on video. That according to a new paper published in the journal Scientific Reports. Just think, ladies and gents, there are people who get paid to unravel these great mysteries of space and time. Ars Technica reporting that from a physics standpoint, those mixed nuts are an example of granular material like a sand pile and what is known as granular convection. And this essentially involves two complementary processes, percolation and convection. Percolation, according to Jennifer Owlett, writing there for Ars Technica, causes smaller grains to move through larger grains to the bottom of the pile, while convection does kind of the opposite. It pushes the larger grains toward the top. But as she notes, complicating matters is gravity, pulling down on every grain, as well as the fact that every individual grain is jostling against all the others in the container, producing friction and mechanical energy, which is lost as heat. Now, as she reports, scientists know that the size and shape of the nuts determines how much friction is produced, and their density also plays a role. Large particles that are less dense than other particles around them rise to the top and stay there, as do particles that are denser than those surrounding them. And so if the difference in density between all the particles is too small, the particles will just stay mixed. But wait, there's more, because air pressure also plays a role, since that density dependence isn't present if the particles, or the nuts in this case, are in a vacuum, as does the shape of the container. Long story short, though, I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this. I'm sure some of you guys out there spotted that from more than 50 astronomical units away. That's right. Whoever is piloting the UFOs figured this out a long time ago. You guessed it. By studying the Brazil nut effect, they no doubt unlocked the mysteries of anti-gravity. And that's what powers the Tic Tacs. Well, that's at least one hypothesis, huh? Speaking of hypotheses about UFOs, I'm going to get to a few of yours in listener emails when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, exploring the great mysteries of our existence, like the Brazil nut effect. I have wondered about that one for years. The real reason I've always talked about those sleepless nights, it was because I was laying awake at night wondering about that Brazil nut effect. Really glad we've figured that one out. But of course, a lot of you guys were writing to me with thoughts and observations that you made about last week's program and some of the recent reporting that we've been doing as it relates to UFOs. And so periodically, I do like to get to the listener emails when we have time. We have one of those golden windows of opportunity right now. And so to get to a few of those, Giles leads off here with his question. He says, "Hi, I was listening to this show again today. Do you think that what are being described as drones now are the same things that were previously called Foo Fighters during the war? Just a thought, enjoying the podcast." Well, that is an interesting thought, and I have wondered about that on occasion myself. You know, the Foo Fighters during World War II, they were often described as luminous balls of light, and modern scientists like to look at those and say, well, you know, but these were just ball lightning. We now know lightning sprites and other similar phenomena probably can account for those. But if you actually go back and read some of those Foo Fighter reports, not only were there balls of light by themselves, there were sometimes formations of balls of light. One of the interesting cases that I read just the other day involved a World War II sighting where the pilots observed a group of these lights flying in a T pattern, which held that pattern as these lights moved through the air and changed altitude, descending and ascending. They maintained this T shape, and so if that's a natural phenomena, again, this is something that is very peculiar, far more peculiar than just random blobs of light that might otherwise be explained by little understood atmospheric phenomena. And yes, I'm talking about ball lightning because, again, as well as it is understood today, it is still not fully understood. We can't replicate it very easily in the laboratory, and we still don't know entirely what mechanism allows for a self-contained orb of electrical energy to manifest naturally in nature. But on the other side of that, there are some of the Foo Fighter reports that, to me, do sound a whole lot like ball lightning. They don't sound anything like anything mechanical or anything drone-like. But it is interesting that if UAP or unusual objects are being observed these days, and we are calling them drones because they appear to be unmanned aerial vehicles, you know, it is interesting to consider whether they might not be the same thing as some of the objects that were being observed decades ago before the proliferation of drones that everybody was flying. Not just the military, but of course civilian pilots too. I own a drone. And I had predicted this a number of years ago. I wrote an article, I think maybe in New Dawn magazine, where I had been saying that in the coming years, as we see more and more drones, it's going to shift aspects of the narrative about the UFO phenomenon. But at that time, what I thought would probably end up happening is that we would be seeing more UFO sightings because more people would be flying drones. Not that there would be unidentified objects that, for lack of any better explanation, people would start calling UAVs, and that some UFO sightings would actually begin to be referred to as drones. Now, of course, there is the possibility that some of the sightings that we were talking about last week, again, the title of the episode, Drones and Destroyers, right? Even I concede that some of the objects in the photos and the video that have been released in recent days do look a lot like, to me, they could be drones. Ty Rogaway over there at the War Zone had a very lengthy article where he laid out the case that he thinks, indeed, we have possibly drones being operated by adversary nations, and that the U.S. military is basically allowing people to act like these things are UFOs, maybe even fostering certain belief in that, which indeed might be advantageous to them for a number of reasons. But, again, it seems that the drone component in modern UFO studies is unavoidable, and for a lot of different reasons. William writes, "Dear Micah, in your recent podcast on UAPs, you spoke of drones which had buzzed Navy ships. Question, did these drones have propellers like regular drones, or was their means of propulsion unknown? Thanks, William." That's a good question, William. There's a lot to be left to the imagination in the very brief footage that has appeared online in recent days. For my own part, I would say it's too difficult to make out in the videos whether there are propellers or what other kind of propulsion system might be carrying these objects aloft. And so although I could not answer your question, I would simply say that based on what I see in the footage, you know, I couldn't rule out that these are some sort of more conventional technology. They don't seem to be anything that is completely unexplainable, if that makes sense. But I don't see propellers in the video either. Now, in recent days, another interpretation of the footage also has to do with the idea that rather than actually being shaped like triangles, it could be the case that the objects in the video are the result of the way that the lens of the night vision gear and, notably, the smartphone that was being held up to the eyepiece in order to obtain those pieces of footage, that actually could have created an artifact that gave the appearance of triangles when in fact these drones may have looked like nothing of the sort. But some sources have actually noted, I think it was Jeremy Corbell there in his original post, that the observers at the time said that they perceived these objects as being pyramid-shaped rather than just being triangles. So they at least said that that trianguloid shape was the actual appearance of the objects. That wasn't just an artifact from the footage, but we don't really know. And frankly, I think what we're going to need is more information before we can draw any conclusions. But William, at least as far as what we see in the footage, I don't see any propellers. Greg writes, Micah, while listening to the podcast, I heard you mention the committee's classing, or rather classifying, some of the information as secret and top secret. It occurred to me some of that could be because of things as unexciting as the UAP's effect on Navy Aegis combat systems or possible exposure of vulnerabilities in our combat systems. Best regards, Greg. Also a great point, Greg, and, you know, when the Pentagon released their videos last spring, about a year ago, they had said that after a complete review of those videos, they could not find anything that was sensitive in terms of national security that would prevent those videos from being released. And while I think a lot of people would immediately presume, well, if they are saying that there's nothing sensitive in these videos, then these videos aren't important. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, it could very well be that the military did film what we, by definition, would call unidentified flying objects, but these videos were cleared for release because they didn't expose any vulnerabilities in our own technology or any very important information about how that technology works. They don't seem to depict any kind of technologies that the public shouldn't know about. And I would think that really, in terms of military prioritization, they would be more concerned about concealing information about our own weapons systems and other technologies rather than something that might belong to somebody else but which can't be identified. So yeah, the reason for secrecy probably would have more to do with what any videos or photographs or other information might convey about our own technologies and operations rather than the prospective unknowns. So that's a fair point. Rick also writes, Hello Micah. Your Micah Hanks podcast this week made me think of emailing you on a thought I have had for a bit of time now. It's purely just a thought I've had in my head due to my lack of time and experience doing that thing called research. One day I probably will, but just had to shoot you this email to get your thoughts on it. On the topic of what UFOs and extraterrestrials could be, let's go down a different path. What if they were neither extra or terrestrial? There's been life on this planet, in the oceans, far longer than there's been life on land, which led to humanity's evolution. And as far as we humans are concerned, the oceans remain largely unknown. We don't know what's down there. So what if we were not the first intelligent and sentient life to evolve? And what if that life evolved in the oceans, and far earlier than we did? They'd have had time to have gone much further in advancement than us, far enough to have the technology to have developed these things we call UFOs, and even further, to be able to hide themselves. Granted, I might have borrowed this idea from a certain Marvel Universe movie. I've been thinking about this for a while, though, and hadn't put it into words until now. Maybe I'm just overthinking this or putting puzzle pieces together that don't belong in the same puzzle, but what are your thoughts? And thanks for all you do. Rick. Well, thank you, Rick, as always, for your feedback. I appreciate that, my man. And as far as my thoughts on what you outline right there, you know, I wouldn't put anything off the table when it comes to UFOs. I really wouldn't. I have certainly thought that the USO component, which we've done podcasts about in the past, Tim McMillan and I keep threatening to write a lengthy article about it, and this is certainly something that what data we have on hand about what the UAP task force has been examining at least seems to entail the idea of these transmedium vehicles, vehicles which can travel through the air as easily as they can through the water. Now, there is no technology that I know of that can match the reported capabilities of some UFOs. I had a friend who actually did send me a video a while back, actually from a number of years ago, and I think that this was an experiment at MIT where a drone was being flown over a swimming pool, and then they take it for a dive, and this drone's able to operate underwater as easily as it does in the air. So, at least as far as concepts for transmedium vehicles, I mean, certainly there are things that have been developed. Certainly there have been implications as far as research efforts and technologies being developed. Over the years, some of my pal Brett Tingley's reporting on the Navy UFO patents at least points in that direction, but again, currently there is no data that supports that there are actively technologies in use that are capable of doing anything comparable to what is reported of these UFOs, and which has been now for decades. You know, there are a number of incidents, even from the Blue Book files, that describe objects going into the water and coming out of the water. And every now and then I do encounter those rather combative individuals on Twitter who want to say, I would believe this stuff was something unexplained if it weren't for the fact that our military has already admitted that they have it. It's our own stuff. And I'm like, what did they admit that they had? Where were the technological developments that facilitated the kind of thing that people have been describing they've been seeing since at least the 1940s? You know, the idea of the transmedium vehicle, that might be an expression we use today. We may be trying to develop technology like that today, but people have been observing some apparent technology that could do that for decades, if you've gone back and done your homework and read the Blue Book files. And another good place to go and review documentation about cases like that would be Project 1947, run by Jan Aldrich. I've been in touch with him, and I want to try and get him and Barry Greenwood on the program in the weeks ahead. But yes, Project 1947 has a lot of those listed as well. But my point is, coming back to what Rick's talking about, whether or not they have evolved in the ocean, that would be a very good place to maintain concealment. And indeed, UFOs do appear to do this from time to time. They are able to travel through the water, and that certainly helps them evade detection. But taking that one step further, what if they actually are from here, and they aren't just using the waterways? Again, considering the fact that much of the Earth's surface, actually a majority of it, is covered with water, they aren't using that just as a medium through which they can be less easily detected. What if they actually reside there and are from there? I mean, it's possible. Who knows? Although, one thing that does kind of complicate that perspective to me is, how likely would it be that a significantly advanced civilization would have actually risen to technological superiority ahead of us and remain hidden from us right here on Earth? I mean, if it were ever proven that a technologically superior civilization existed right here alongside us and that they were actually Earthlings, and they were so technologically sophisticated, which makes them so good at concealment, that since the rise of civilization, we have only heard whispers about their existence in our myths and our folklore over the ages. If that were ever proven to be true, I have to imagine that would probably upset all of our thinking, not only about life in the universe, but also about life here on Earth. But then again, when it comes to the UFO mystery, really, I sometimes think it is either one of two things, far more complicated or a whole lot simpler than we probably make it out to be. Maybe Larry Hancock will have some thoughts about that as we discuss national intelligence in relation to the UFO problem with him when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. What do our intelligence agencies actually know about the UFO phenomenon? How complex is it? And what can we learn about it from approaching the data that we have like an intelligence assessment? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. And I am extremely eager to have the conversation we are about to embark upon tonight. My guest is Larry Hancock, who brings his formal training in history and cultural anthropology to his research and writing on Cold War history and national security subjects. And yes, he is also a longtime UFO buff. Now, his career in computer communications and technology marketing allowed him the opportunity to become involved in and consult on strategic analysis and planning studies. And so, drawing from his experience in that realm, he has applied this toward his studies of UFOs as a member of the organization of which I am also a part, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. And so, without further ado, welcome to the program, Larry Hancock. How are you?
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy it's spring. Things are good.
Yeah, likewise. It's spring here in the mountains, and so if my throat is any scratchier than it normally sounds, that would be why. But, you know, right here at the outset, I do want to thank you here on the show. Larry, you were really helpful in helping me get suited up and equipped to join the SCU and its efforts to try and bring science and awareness, really, overall, to the UAP subject. So, you know, truly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for your help with that. And it's, I couldn't imagine a better group of professionals to be linked up with examining this very timely and significant issue.
Oh, I appreciate that. And we're happy about the group. We're growing slowly, but that's the whole goal, because we, quite frankly, to do the kind of studies we want to do, it requires a real commitment, requires time. And, you know, we're looking for involvement in actual scientific studies. And to do that, you know, you don't need 20,000 people. You just need some folks that are really dedicated and willing to follow the rules.
That's right. Absolutely. You know, something that immediately interested me, and I told you this when you and I started corresponding, we have almost identical interests in terms of our academic interests, because your background, of course, you majored in history and cultural anthropology. And that really has to do with a lot of my own research. As a cultural, well, a person with a background in history and cultural anthropology, how do you feel like that kind of colors and shapes your perspective of the UFO topic and the history of it?
Well, I think part of the training with that, it's very important for in cultural anthropology to look for patterns, because quite frankly, whether it's an old society, you know, basically an indigenous society or culture that, you know, has been there for a long time, or even a contemporary grouping, you know, a group, a clique, an organization that has emerged more recently, you have to approach it as an unknown. You can't make any assumptions. You have to accept it for what it is. And you have to approach it in a very step-by-step manner and start looking for patterns. I mean, patterns are the clue to cultural anthropology. Linguistics is a starting point, but once you get to the point of actually being able to communicate, you're trying to define patterns of behavior, which are largely affected by, you know, beliefs, mores, those sorts of activities. They're kind of under the surface. You know, people don't necessarily talk about them. They do act in regard to them, and you have to ferret out what those core motivations and core guidelines and core patterns are. And certainly that applies to UAPs if we're going to do more than look incident by incident. I mean, incident by incident, you can do scientific studies, and that's fine. You can look for unconventional flight characteristics or G-loads or that sort of thing. But if you want to step back and look at the broader phenomena, you have to look for patterns, and that's what happens in anthropology, cultural anthropology at least.
Yeah, and actually in other disciplines maybe too. I immediately think of Lewis Benford back in the 1960s and the idea of archaeology as anthropology. He really, you know, kind of was a game changer in the field, where he was saying, up until now, archaeology has been the collection of artifacts and the documentation of different types. But he says, if we can kind of start analyzing what the actual meaning is and what can be inferred about the life of the people who made these artifacts, we can learn more about the ancient past. And it was really kind of a paradigm shift in archaeology. I feel like in a lot of ways, UAP studies or ufology, whatever we want to call it, that also is kind of in that stage where we are collecting data, but hopefully in the years ahead, like archaeology or anthropology did and other disciplines, hopefully the science of UAP studies will move into an area where we begin to look at the data and try to discern things from it. Would you agree that maybe we're in a similar sort of pre-scientific or early scientific stage with UAP?
I certainly would, and it's fascinating that you bring up Benford, because Benford is out of my era of anthropology, and at the University of New Mexico, Benford was a guiding light in the studies at that point in time. My instructors were very much of that generation, mm-hmm. and were looking at that kind of taking archaeology to the next level.
Right.
So Benford's a very familiar name for me. It's been a long time since I heard that, actually.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that, of course, I figured, too, with your background, that you would have an appreciation for that. I really want to see, you know, UFOs go in a similar direction where we can begin to incorporate all the data we've collected in ways toward trying to discern patterns and maybe even glean some idea about the operation, the technologies, and what have you. But, you know, part of getting us to that point has really been the analysis of documents related to this. And although we all want to see more science applied to it, really, ufology, maybe in the 20th century and the early 21st century, has in large part been trying to get more information released from government agencies to help us build a historical narrative around which the UAP can be placed into the proper context. You have done maybe more than most people have. I've heard in past interviews, Larry, where you've described having read most of the literature. Here, I'm trying to get caught up on all that stuff. I'm just 38 years old and doing a lot of reading these days. You've also poured through documents. You've spent time at the National Archives. You have read a tremendous amount about this, and I think it's fair to understand why you have referred to yourself as a document geek. Can we talk about how you got into trying to pursue the phenomenon from that angle?
Sure, and I do have one advantage there, of course. I became interested and started reading about UAPs, UFOs, circa 1964. Uh-huh. So, you know, at that point in time, the 60s were, you could hardly read a newspaper or magazine through 64, 65, 66, 67, through that decade without crossing UFOs, you know. And I started my book collection then, not document collection, but book collection, and was an relatively early member of APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, of NICAP, got their newsletters, followed that. So that gives me a bit of a head start on it. However, document-wise, I would say that really, document-wise, started with reading the Condon Report and the books that followed the Condon Report back in the late 60s. Getting into, you know, what documents had Condon studied, what documents had he not studied, what documents were there, really, how was information being collected, what did the Air Force have, what did they share, so that goes back a long way in time. My reset with documents began in the 90s when I started doing some work in other areas, quite frankly, basically in intelligence, Cold War history, that sort of thing, on the military side. And I did a huge amount of work in FBI files, CIA files, military files, and after you read, you know, 10 or 15,000 pages of documents, you almost force yourself to learn how these people work, you know, how the reports are written, how the headers are, what the numbering system is, how do you start tracking from one to the other. And that period, basically my document period, was something at that point in time like 20 years of just literally delving into different documents from many agencies, not just related to UAP, is because I was writing on books such as on topics of covert intelligence and strategic threats and warnings. And, you know, when you look at my books, they're pretty broad in nature, which took me into a very broad range of documents. And I think I go back to the point in time in the 90s when we were going, you know, gosh, it would be great if we didn't have to go to the archives all the time. It would be great if we didn't have to use the copy machine. It's really expensive because I'll request an FBI document and I'll pay $50 for 20 copies of the same 3 pages because that's what's in the file. And we discovered HTML and we discovered coding, and that was like a revelation. It's like, you know, gosh, we could scan this stuff and we could make it searchable and we could put it online. And I actually ended up becoming a board member on the Mary Farrell Foundation, which archives Cold War history, 60s and 70s documents. And we've got maybe 1.5 million closing in on 2 million pages of documents online. And I guess if anything justifies myself calling myself a document geek, it would be that sort of obsession with going to source material. And the exciting thing about UAPs is, and I got to say, I didn't do this. NICAP did it. Brad Sparks did it. There's Kevin Randall did it. There's tremendous amount of work that went into getting the Air Force Blue Book files on microfiche, microfilm, making that shareable. We have a far better database for historical research on UFOs than most of the other fields I deal with. And it's really kind of amazing that these days we see all kinds of articles written about UAPs without many of them touching on the history before the last, now, 5-10 years. I often feel it's like the people who are writing about it go, wow, you know, UFOs began with the Nimitz incident, you know, and gosh, these things are unconventional. And I keep going to other folks at SCU going, no, we actually have exactly those same kind of reports from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. This is not new.
Oh, boy, do you ever. Again, you know, UFOs and government, right? That's just a textbook, I think, that people should read. The work of so many of the SCU members, you know, Michael Swords and Robert Powell, though, the UFO History Group. You know, I try to reach out to as many of these kinds of people and researchers as I possibly can because of the significance of understanding the history of the phenomena. You're so right, Larry. In recent years, people will say, well, you know, now it appears that there's some unusual technology. Yes, we can call these quote unquote UFOs because by definition, that's what they are, but they probably belong to China or to Russia. And I always point out to people, look, remember former CIA director Roscoe Hillencutter, 1961. At that point, he was retired. He was now a member of NICAP, and he was saying, whatever these unconventional aerial objects are that we're observing, they are far too sophisticated to be anything that Russia or China could have. And I'm thinking, my gosh, there's truly nothing new under the sun. He was saying that in 1961, decades ago. But so many people who are new to this topic, they act as though it just started, you know, shortly after the turn of the last century, you know? It's been around for a while.
And I think that's part of the scientific study as well. For example, SCU members are very involved in looking at cases that have enough technical data so that you can look at G-loads and acceleration and, you know, flight characteristics that are certainly unconventional for a manned aircraft, any kind of manned device. But, you know, and people say, well, okay, so it wasn't manned, it was a drone, and it can do that. But we find that same data if you go back to 1967 and go to the Minot incident, a missile base in North Dakota. We have radar maps and from airborne aircraft, and we have tracking photographs, and you can calculate and see the same kind of accelerations and G-loading back then, and that certainly wasn't a Chinese drone. You can go back further in time. One of my favorites is one of the early atomic storage sites where, fascinating story, it was during a period of time that the grudge period when the Air Force was collecting reports but kind of really didn't want to hear it. They started in 1947. They tried to explain it, thought they could explain it, didn't explain it, and you know, what you do at that point in time is you want to avoid it, really. It's, would you people stop reporting this stuff because the boss asked me questions I can't answer? So this happened at one of these atomic depots that was being, weapons depots that was setting up. And it happened to be by an Army base where the Army was doing artillery training. And so they had all of these folks that were being trained as artillery spotters, using optical equipment, and this is a very precise work with artillery placement. And the Army was so upset about what was going on, they made a whole series of measurements of these things and supplied it to the Air Force, who then just totally ignored it. But that data itself shows dramatically unconventional extreme accelerations, G-loads, that sort of thing. So again, the story is the big story is in the history, and that these anomalous behaviors are not new. In fact, they're quite comparable over a period of 67 years, which is should be beginning to tell us something.
Yes. Again, we should have enough data also that we should be able to maybe glean certain things about the nature of the phenomena, its operation, and what have you. My guest is Larry Hancock of the SCU, and he is not only a commentator on UFOs, but also someone who has put in a whole lot of work behind the scenes and on the record, analyzing the government's involvement with it and a whole host of other things. As outlined in his book, Unidentified, The National Intelligence Problem of UFOs, we're going to get into that with him when we come back after this. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and we will be right back. Welcome back. Eyes on the skies tonight as we continue to probe the mystery of unidentified aerial phenomena, more commonly known, of course, as UFOs. My guest, Larry Hancock, a fellow member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, certainly one who is more involved than yours truly, having recently arrived. But Larry's been in this for a long time. In fact, actually, even before his involvement with the SCU, Larry's been a long time researcher, and someone who looks at this from that national security and also intelligence collecting standpoint. So we're going to get into some discussion with him here in just a bit about his book, and this is one that everyone should probably read, Unidentified, The National Intelligence Problem of UFOs. First, of course, I do want to remind you, if you aren't already a subscriber to the X podcasts of this program, you're only getting half of the conversation, because every week we go a bit deeper, as we will do this week with Larry Hancock. And I got to tell you, some of the instances of possible communication with UAP, even from the early years, I mean, some really, really hair-raising stuff. We're going to get into that for subscribers. But again, every week, we continue the conversation with the X podcast. And of course, there are also the monthly specials, the Enigmas specials that we provide too. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. Definitely check that out. And of course, also check out in the show notes where we will have links to where you can follow Larry's work, the SCU's work, and also where you can find his book, Unidentified, The National Intelligence Problem of UFOs, which we might as well get into with him now. Larry, I want to ask you, let's talk about the only time that the Office of Scientific Intelligence, the CIA, almost recommended that the UFO issue be elevated to the National Security Council and tasked as an actual intelligence priority. It almost happened. Can we talk about that?
It did. It almost happened, and it would have been a real breakthrough, because I think this is, to get your mind around that, it's important to understand how the Air Force and the Navy during the earliest period, the 40s and the 50s, approached, they definitely approached UFOs as a potential threat. And rightly so. I mean, the military, that's their task. And quite frankly, the first air intelligence estimate of the situation identified the most likely sources being the Soviet Union. And they really thought that what they were seeing was some German advanced aircraft technology being applied by the Soviets, the Russians, and being used for reconnaissance, possibly even for in preliminary strike work. So they were very concerned about it. But the bottom line is that they went down that road and it proved not to be that. And so they didn't have a good answer. What they kept doing, though, is that didn't make the reports go away. They kept getting them, and they kept taking them one at a time. And what you get stuck into when you do that is, I think Dr. Hynek once said it, most gracefully. It basically is any individual UFO report, if submitted to a scientific panel, can be rejected because there is some, always will be, some explanation other than an unidentified flying object that the scientific community will turn to, because you can always come up with some sort of answer, whether it's an observational mistake, atmospherics, misidentification of natural phenomena, whatever. You always come up with something. Well, okay, that's the way the Air Force was approaching it, and taking it one at a time, and to the point up through 1950 and 1951 under a project called Grudge, which is kind of an interesting code word. It's sort of like, okay.
Yeah, right.
Project Grudge followed Project Sign. Project Sign, you know, it's kind of like, oh, there's a sign of something going on here. Well, Grudge is, we don't want to see that stuff.
Yeah.
But to get to your question, the point is, we get to 1951, 1952, and the reports haven't gone away. And as a matter of fact, the general in charge of air intelligence gets upset because he had been told that all of these things are explainable. You know, these are all mistaken. You know, that just, you don't have to worry about these, boss. Don't have to worry about them. Well, you go through several months of the year 1952 when he has to face the fact that he's scrambling interceptors almost constantly over up the East Coast. Day by day, there's an intensifying air defense activity that's going on, and you can't ignore it. And you know, basically he goes back and says, you know, are these people, you know, did they take this seriously? And he gets upset about it and assigns some new people to it, and they start taking it seriously and looking for patterns, quite frankly. And one of the first patterns they found at that point in time was a serious pattern of UFO incidents over the atomic warfare complex sites in the southwest U.S., Los Alamos, Kirtland, Sandia Base in Albuquerque, White Sands, different installations, and they really, again, concluded that it looked like there was Soviet reconnaissance going on that should be taken seriously. Well, they were getting ready and actually recommending setting up a network, an observation network, to try to attempt to get a handle on this. And then what really happened was in the summer of 1952, there were a series of incidents over Washington, D.C., very high-profile incidents in which multiple aircraft, commercial aircraft pilots, ground radar tractors, air defense radar tractors, but commercial air radar units were reporting these things as very real. And this actually became very embarrassing because many people have written about this, but one of the reasons it had such an impact was not only the publicity, but the Air Force, for whatever reason, had to admit that it was taking them 45 minutes to an hour and a half from the reports being generated to putting an interceptor over the nation's capital.
Wow.
Now, this is early in the Cold War. This is right after Korea. This is, you know, people are very sensitive, and it's like, okay, their headlines are not at all, you know, reassuring. You know, Air Force responds hours late. You know, what if this really had been a Soviet bomber strike? Well, it was so bad that the president actually, you know, this became an issue of public relations right at the presidential level. And the president called the Air Force in and said, well, explain this. You know, it can't be as bad as it looks. Make me feel better about this.
Reassure me.
Unfortunately, they couldn't. And, you know, we don't know all about the dialogue that went on, but he actually had a meeting with some Air Force generals and staff. And we have simply the title on the meeting log says, Defense of the Capitol. Now, you got to think, picture in your mind, the president is calling in Air Force intelligence and asking them to talk about the defense of the Capitol when they just failed to put an interceptor over Washington for an hour and a half.
Boy.
It had to be an unpleasant meeting.
I'd say so.
And they did not satisfy the president. So as a recourse, he's not satisfied with what the Air Force is doing. He calls up the CIA director and says, okay, you guys, you have a technical intelligence group. You know, look into this. Tell me if I should be as worried about it as it seems like I should be. And interestingly enough, the CIA had not been involved with this. People are kind of shocked about that, but the two groups that had primarily been involved with it had been the Air Force, and then at various of the atomic sites, the FBI had actually been very involved with reports at Oak Ridge in Tennessee, at Los Alamos, in Albuquerque. So it had been up to the Air Force and the FBI. The CIA, you know, this is all domestic activity. They might file a report on something that appeared in the newspaper overseas, but they weren't into it. So the Office of Technical Intelligence, it's kind of interesting. They almost immediately, within a matter of a couple of weeks, said, well, we looked at what the Air Force is doing. We don't think they do a very good job, but we don't really think there's much into it, but we'll take a better look. Over the next couple of months, they started meeting with the folks from Wright-Patterson, from Air Intelligence, and within, I think, 2 months, 3 months at the most, the head of technical intelligence at the CIA came back to the CIA director and said, this is a national crisis. Yeah, there is something going on over our atomic warfare complex that looks very much like purposeful reconnaissance. Somebody is probing it. We need to up the ante on this. We need to elevate this to the National Security Council and make it a tasking for the national intelligence community, because it had not been. It had been strictly a service thing, strictly the Air Force. We need to get this elevated so the National Security Council assigns it to the very high level groups that look at it from a strategic standpoint, that not just incident by incident, but start looking at patterns, start doing a threat assessment. The CIA director was initially very responsive. And to get to the National Security Council, though, all of this is rather bureaucratic. The National Security Council itself had its own intelligence advisory group, the IEC. So he went to them, and we have the memos. I discussed this explicitly in the book, and I have to say the person who has done the most and the best detailed document work on this is Brad Sparks. There's just no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of what I write is derived from his research as well as other sources. But what happened at that point in time is this advisory council said, you know, this is a pretty wild subject. This is, you know, there's been no scientific endorsement of this. We're willing to let you come do a brief and make this to the National Security Council to make it a high-level intelligence tasking. But first, you have to get some scientific endorsement for this. You have to line up some scientists that will say this is something real. It's not just all of those typical, you know, misidentifications, bad physics, bad astronomy. Then, you know, regardless of what the head of technical intelligence has said, you know, we don't care. You're going to have to get an endorsement before we allow this to go up the chain. The director of the CIA at that point in time said, well, okay. I mean, it's clear. You can see it's clear in the document that he begins to waffle. Like, okay, is my career worth this? You know, what? That's a point in time in it goes over the winter months, late 1952 and into 53, where they go back, the CIA goes back to the Air Force, says, well, we're going to convene a scientific panel. And the Air Force folks are really excited because that's what they've been pushing for all the while. This panel is convened, but part of the story there is it's really hard to get any scientists to serve on it because, A, they're really not interested in this. This is not a topic, you know, they have research of their own they're doing. They're into whether it's atomic research or atmospheric or whatever. They have to work on drafting these people and actually pressure them in and get them special classifications to set on the panel. And it's just a real struggle to even convene the panel. When they convene the panel under Chairman Robertson, they actually begin with a briefing that positions the whole study more in terms of a psychological study than anything else, essentially evaluating the UFO phenomena as a potential element of psychological warfare. How is this going to affect the service's ability to respond if there's an actual Soviet attack? Will an enemy be able to essentially spoof the nation by faking UFO incidents and diverting attention as a prelude to an actual strike? And it's very strange when you look at the rest of the meeting, because they essentially collect a group of physical scientists and ask them to do a psychological assessment, which is what they end up doing.
Right.
And the net result is they don't really engage in the good reports. Even Dr. Hynek, who was invited and was present for portions of the section, concluded that they didn't seriously engage with the hard science.
Right.
They basically knocked off reports with easy answers so that they could proceed with the psychological aspect. They came back and wrote a report that appears in a way to have been, you know, that this decision had been made in advance that this was going to be characterized as a psychological threat issue, not a physical threat issue. And based on that report and the lack of scientific panel's endorsement, it ended right there. If the things that were done as a result were all in regard to, you know, public relations, internal propaganda, let's diminish the seriousness of these UFO reports. We want people to think we don't want people to worry. We're getting way too many reports as it is. We need to diminish that. Let's go that direction. And so it died. It aborted at that point in time. And neither then nor, as far as we can tell, any time to the present, has this subject ever been tasked at a National Security Council level. And by that, I mean, intelligence isn't random. The intelligence agencies, especially the strategic groups, they have a list of things that they're supposed to be watching as threats. There's a tasking list, and it's published, and you know what the priorities are, and that's where the time and money is supposed to be spent. And those are people that do the patterns analysis, the real strategic threats and warning analysis. And they look at something on their tasking list, and there's a process, you know, like, okay, we're going to look at it, and we're going to characterize it, and we're going to keep looking at it and see if there are trends and patterns that concern us. And that has never been done to UFOs or UAPs as far as we know.
You know, they say that first impressions are everything. And sometimes I can't help but think that some of those early developments with regard to government involvement with this topic really did kind of set a precedent, and one that would increasingly with time result in more and more either avoidance or, at its worst sometimes, even dismissal or ridicule. We're talking, by the way, with Larry Hancock of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies and author of the book Unidentified, The National Intelligence Problem of UFOs. And when we come back after this, I want to get Larry's perspective on that very troublesome document which emerged from this era, which indicates the fact that there was another UFO study underway at the same time as the Robertson panel. We'll get into that and much more here on the other side of this break. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and we will be right back after this. Continuing our conversation with Larry Hancock of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, and boy, what a conversation this is. You know, he is truly one of those experts that you could talk to probably for months, if not years, about this subject. And of course, he has poured decades into the study of these kinds of documents. Of course, the culmination of his research, his book, Unidentified: The National Intelligence Problem of UFOs, that, of course, is part of what we're discussing with him tonight, but there's so much on the table, so many topics to cover, so little time indeed. I can already tell we're going to have him back at some point. Now, Larry, I do want to ask you, while the Robertson panel is being convened, we also have thousands of UFO reports that are being analyzed by the Battelle Memorial Institute for the U.S. Air Force. And, of course, we have that famous memorandum, which has been, I think, seen as more controversial over the years than it really should have been. Dr. Jacques Vallée refers to it as the Pentacle Memorandum, but, of course, what we're talking about was Howard Cross writing about the fact that, hey, you know, before this panel is convened, you guys should wait. We're analyzing some reports, and this might actually be useful if you had the data that we're about to provide. This, of course, resulting in Project Blue Book Special Report number 14. It's interesting to me that at that time we have the Robertson panel, their attitude, their approach, and their conclusions, and then we have the analysis of thousands of Blue Book reports, which, of course, many commentators over the years who have analyzed what the Battelle Memorial Institute provided to the Air Force, they actually say that there are more unidentified, I mean, genuine unidentifieds in that report than what the actual data that they indicate seems to provide. So it's a very unusual time where there seem to be conflicting attitudes about how severe the problem was, what it might have represented, and how to approach it in terms of intelligence.
There were, and I think the Air Force at that point in time, as I said, the general in charge of air intelligence had become very frustrated because during the grudge period, he had been getting reports basically saying there's nothing to this. And that was the official position. It was, we'll take this one at a time. There must be a reasonable explanation for this. We'll work on them. And then this, it didn't go away. So he became very frustrated. There's actually a very interesting record of the meeting in which he was having a meeting and called in the people from Wright-Patterson, who were most closely involved in the studies, and they had, there were some new officers assigned there, and they were taking it much more seriously than some of their predecessors had. Let's put it that way, because they were new. It was during the Korean War, at the end of the Korean War, and they were taking it as a real potential threat. So the general calls him in the office and says, you know, what's really going on? You guys are the ones that are doing this. You tell me. I've been getting reports for 2 years that there's nothing to this, and I need to hear it directly from you. And as the story is told, by Ruppelt, basically the person who was in the meeting from Wright-Patterson was about to get, he was leaving the Air Force, his tour of duty was over, he was going back to be a civilian, and basically he just told the general what the truth really was. These guys are sitting on this stuff, they don't care, they laugh about it, they throw it in the waste paper basket. You know, nobody's really been taking this seriously, General. I don't care what they told you, that's what I've seen. It's one of those critical periods in time where somebody briefs a general officer who just really doesn't, you know, the guy doing delivering their marks has no constraint. I'm going to tell it like it is. I'm leaving the Air Force. You know, it's your problem. Here's what's been happening. And the general just went berserk and said, I am going to have an answer to this. I don't care. You know, and if anybody lies to me again, they're going to end up, you know, cleaning runways in Alaska. And that's described in the book as well. But the point was that from that point on, for a period of year and a half, things were taken very seriously. And you had people in Blue Book, like Ruppelt, who were starting to do serious intelligence studies of it and actually contracting for things like the Battelle study. So you had a small number of officers at Blue Book who were taking it very seriously, and it was their job, and they had even convinced the heads of air intelligence to take it seriously. So there's this short period of time where everyone is taking it seriously. They want an answer. And that was the prelude to what we just discussed. The Air Force, the people that are directly involved in it are very serious about it. The rest of the intelligence community isn't even engaged with it. But you run into a clash of careers. When it moved up to the point that we just talked to, people, scientists having to lay their careers on the line, the CIA director having to lay his career on the line, endorsing it as a subject to be studied. There comes a point when there's a very real career conflict when you're studying a subject that is esoteric at best, you know, that doesn't have a wealth of science, or I shouldn't say doesn't have a wealth of science behind it, doesn't have a wealth of scientific endorsement behind it.
Certainly.
Which is kind of strange. One of the things that's been discovered over the years is that the Air Force actually sent Dr. Hynek out to covertly see how much scientific interest in it. I think this is fascinating. Dr. Hynek went to a number of professional astronomers. He went to astronomical conferences, and he was well known and in the field, and he would ask people privately about it. And the majority of the astronomers that he talked to thought it was very real, thought it should be studied, but were very clear in expressing to him that even if they saw something themselves, they would not talk about it or write about it because it would kill their careers.
Right.
And of course, we have James McDonnell, Dr. McDonnell, and his story later, that this subject has been the death of way too many careers. And so, to answer your question, that happens in the military too. It doesn't just happen in the scientific community. There were periods of time when this was seen as a positive for your career if the head of air intelligence was interested in it. At other times, when it was clear that the senior officers wanted it to go away, that's what happened.
Yeah, and that really starts to kind of illustrate what you have termed the national intelligence problem of UFOs. But another aspect of this that I have kind of begun to pick up on is that at various times, especially early on, and maybe still today, there was a bit of a divide between the military and the intelligence gathering side of it and the scientific community. The scientists saying, well, if this is potentially an enemy, because we know it's not something more exotic than that, then this isn't our problem. This is a problem for the military. I mean, we're concerned, but this is something that they need to try and approach from an intelligence gathering and also from a threat assessment perspective, whereas the military is looking at it and saying, yeah, but, you know, if it's not the enemy and we can't identify what it is in the first place, then it very much could still be a scientific problem. And there's that back and forth. It's yours. No, it's yours. No, it's yours.
And I think from the scientific communities, the problem, of course, they face is it's not reproducible.
Yeah.
You know, any scientific, we need to be able to do experiments, right? You know, it's not science if we can't do experiments, if we can't do a continuing series of experiments, and this isn't that way. you know, it's almost like meteorites were early on when they were considered a phenomena as well, and you couldn't predict them. They were a random event. How could we study them? That must be, you know. So the scientific community has a real problem because this is not a reproducible phenomena subject to experiment.
Yeah.
And how can I sign up? How do I get a graduate student into this? How do I get funding for my research? It's sort of like, well, I'm going to study this again if it happens. Oh, okay, sure. So the scientists have a real problem. The military has a different problem, though. And I think this is something that really emerges. And we see it repeatedly. We even saw it in the late 60s when the Air Force abandoned the whole thing. We see it now. And the military basically has the response of, whatever this is, you know, we will report it. If it's a potential threat, we'll monitor it. And there was something called service reporting, which essentially is what the Navy is doing now. It's sort of a directive that says, if you see something that you think is a threat, report it, and we'll deal with it. But you only deal with it during that period of time. You know, the incident happens, and, you know, there's no damage, there's no engagement, there's nobody's hurt, so clearly it wasn't a threat. And in all of those, what the press releases will say, the military press releases will say is, well, there was no actual threat. There was no damage. This is not, you know, not an adversary. So it's not our problem. Military problems have to do with adversaries that are a potential threat. Well, these things, whatever they are, have been around for decades now, and they haven't attacked us, so this is not on our threat list. Iran is, China is, Russia is, you know, those are our adversaries. These, whatever, you know, this doesn't go on the adversary list. So both parties, the scientist and the military, have a fallback position that says, you know, it really isn't in my area. It's not my task. I will, these days, a UFO, UAP incident might be recorded in a various types of military communications, a operations report, a threat report. But when it's over, it's over. Like the incidents with the drones that are most commonly discussed these days, it doesn't go on. It passed. There's no threat. Whatever this was is not ongoing. So we're done with it. Again, if there's nobody at that higher level saying, well, we're not done with it, we're going to write this down and we're going to look at the broader picture and we're going to look for patterns and whatever. And we just discussed there's nobody doing that. So both the scientist and the military, and I'm not really describing it, it's a natural out. It doesn't fit their obligations. It doesn't fit their job description necessarily.
Right. Our guest is Larry Hancock of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. And when we come back after this, I want to get into some of the other collection methods that were used by government, even going back to those early years of Project Blue Book. Was there data that didn't make its way to Blue Book? Or as Hynek said, maybe Project Blue Book wasn't so blue. We'll get into that with Larry Hancock and much more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Wrapping up this conversation with Larry Hancock of the SCU, Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. arguably one of the best organizations right now that is analyzing this very important phenomena. And in fact, actually, in the days ahead, we will have another of its members joining me on the program, but not just a member of that organization, a guy who is probably best known for being one of the most prolific authors on the subject of UFOs, period. That's Kevin Randall. Dr. Kevin Randall, actually. He'll be joining me next week. So lots to look forward to. And of course, don't forget, ex-subscribers will have a whole lot to look forward to as I continue the conversation with Larry Hancock. Some of the stuff that Larry is going to get into with us for the X-Podcast, I mean, it actually blew my mind. I mean, we're talking about potential instances of communication between the phenomena and aircraft using encoded signals, radio signals, radar jamming, all kinds of interesting things. But we'll get into that, of course, for subscribers. Right now, what I want to talk about are the possible methods of reporting UFOs that fell outside of Project Blue Book. While we had Project Blue Book under the U.S. Air Force, we also had other collection methods. You mentioned the service logs, which a lot of that going to NORAD. We had air intelligence documents that didn't go to Blue Book, Army documents collected on UFOs. You know, you've talked in the past also about the recovery of incidents from the past. Nowadays, it's you know, big deal for UFOs in the Navy because that's the, you know, that's the department under the Pentagon. This is the military branch that seems to have the most involvement with this. But, you know, that's not something new. And to try and find the information about the Navy incidents requires a different process, you know, using ship logs, you know, and things rather than the typical file repositories. So there are a lot of places one has to go and look to try and get information about UFOs. And this brings, of course, the question to mind, well, how much information, for instance, was not going to Blue Book? And if not to Blue Book, where did it go?
The question, I think we have something of an answer to that. For example, we have some examples in the late 1960s, 67, 68, then in the 70s, that have to do with the Strategic Air Command, primarily at the Air Force SAC bases, the Strategic Air Command bases, and the missile fields across North Dakota, Montana, what's normally referred to as the Northern Tier of our defenses up around the border. There were a whole series of incidents up there involving UFOs in very aggressive occurrences. I mean, coming right down and essentially hovering over SAC atomic weapons storage bunkers, hovering over missile silos. So the question is, was that reported to Blue Book? Well, Blue Book was no longer in existence, right?
Yeah.
But we can follow the chain of events, which gives us a clue as to what's happening today. And what happened is those good researchers have indeed found a book, Clear Intent, goes into a great deal of detail on this.
Great book.
Reports did go to NORAD. They went to the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon, as they should. There is a reporting chain that goes from a field unit that encounters anything from an operational problem to a potential threat, a situations report, that goes up the chain of the command. And certainly if it involves a military unit like a ship or an installation, it's going to end up at the National Military Command Center. It should end up within the service at a command level within the service, but it also gets copied. These things get copied a lot. One of the things that, quite frankly, is disconcerting to a lot of us right now is considering how these reports go. One would think that, I mean, it's not like NORAD just stops at the border. You know, NORAD is supposed to be air defense around the entire perimeter of the United States. So if something's happening with a Navy strike group off San Clemente Island and it has to do with an unidentified aerial object, NORAD should be getting a report.
Right.
The Air Force should be getting a report. You would think the National Military Command Center is getting a report. So far, if that's happening, we're not seeing those documents. What the highest level we're seeing are within the Navy command structure. within the units that the ships belong to. So Blue Book was a project for the Air Force to study incidents. We don't really know, although the Admiral's recent response, Admirals seem to suggest that there is a high-level study group. We don't know where it is. But in the period from 1967 on to the present, you'd have to look for, since there's no official study group, no public study group, no public press releases, you'd have to assume that these reports are going up within the national security alert structure. And that's where we should find documents. That's where we found the documents for the incidents in the 60s and 70s at the SAC bases.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, where are the contemporary documents? And that seems to be a stone wall. Nobody's having much luck finding, doing for you and finding documents about the command system outside of the Navy, which is amazing.
Yeah. It may also, and this is just speculation on my part, Larry, but it may have also to do with however the phenomena is termed, whatever it is referred to as in the documents. I remember in the incidents from the 60s and 70s, often you would see things like mystery hellos describing the UFOs. Of course, they never say unidentified flying object. The flying saucer, yeah, the flying saucer came in low over the base and hovered over the reactor. No, you know, they're saying these mysterious helicopters and things like that. They literally had no other way to refer to them, or perhaps chose to refer to them as something, you know, more ambiguous, I guess. And that definitely would make it hard to obtain those documents if you're calling, you know, and asking for UFOs, and they say, well, we don't have anything on that.
Absolutely. And one, it's the documents that I was just referring to in those northern tier sites back over the SAC bases, they actually refer to them as unidentified helicopters.
Yeah.
Although there's absolutely no evidence that they were helicopters. But then you're forced into this unpleasant situation of thinking, well, you know, which would I rather they be? Would I rather they be a UFO, or would I rather them be, you know, a Soviet Spetsnaz special strike team that's able to penetrate my SAC base at will and I can't do anything about it?
Good point.
I'm, you know, it's like, how do I write this up in my report to not sound terribly embarrassing? You know, it's a civilian helicopter that just was managed to wander over my base and I didn't engage with it and nothing happened multiple times at different bases. How did that, my quandary is, when you're talking about national security problems, how was it that some commander didn't get replaced? You know, I can't understand it. That was certainly a problem for the command. But for your overall question, yeah, I think we know where they should be reported. How are they tagged in the reports, and what are the classifications? One of the things that's really making life more difficult for us these days is, I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, things were either observed or they were tracked on radar. Now we have such immensely sophisticated data collection systems, infrared, satellite thermal imaging. There should be all sorts of technology signatures, but nobody would want to tell us about those because that reveals what you can and cannot detect. And I've been having some dialogues online about these recent drone swarm incidents with going, well, you know, they're not going, no one would want to disclose that they could detect and track them or that they couldn't detect and track them because that tells your adversary way too much.
Right.
You're giving away the shop if they're doing this, as we often do. I mean, a standard behavior and data collection between adversaries is things called spoofing and spooking, where you do just that. You fly close to them, you maneuver close to them, you see what equipment they turn on. You monitor their frequencies, electronic information collection. You do all that, and you learn a great deal. But what we saw in this most recent series of drone incidents that are being discussed is the ships in question turned off their electronics, okay, which is great because it's going to frustrate the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
They used passive collections, and they're not telling us much. They're certainly not going to tell us what all the other Navy assets in the area saw and didn't see, because that would give away the store. And because it is so much more complex in terms of data collection, I think we're seeing even less willingness to talk about it. And certainly, we're never going to see that data. That I just cannot believe that they're going to release the data that we need for our technical analysis, because that tells you too much about what can and can't be collected.
Now, you're talking specifically in this regard about the UAP Task Force and its forthcoming report. I mean, the idea that they're going to, the government intelligence agencies are going to give that to the UAP Task Force, and then that it will be made available to the public. You're saying you think that's unlikely?
I think it's unlikely.
Yeah, I do too. Which is not very helpful for scientific organizations that want to try and probe the possibilities that this phenomenon may represent.
And I'm being kind of bipolar about it. I can't see how they could. If I were in their position, I wouldn't either, because their job is strictly, their job, it's mandatory for their job that they don't tell adversaries what they can and cannot see. That's you can't do that and maintain any, either maintain your advantage or communicate your weakness. And so I can't really blame them for not doing that. But it is terribly frustrating if that's what you're looking to do. Yeah. And I think one of our approaches to that is, look, we don't need to see the details of what sensors were doing what. If we could only get some general technical information. In general, what we're looking for is what degree of anomalous behavior is there? You know, what was the acceleration? Don't tell us what you did to measure it. Tell us what it is. So yeah, we can compare that historically, compare it with other incidents, and start doing some analysis. So there are, they could give us some conclusions, and perhaps they will do that. They could say, well, you know, we're not going to give you the data itself. We're going to give you the analysis, basically. And perhaps they will share that to the extent that they're going to have to take a position on whether or not these things are fully unconventional.
Yeah.
And by that I mean, you know, I don't see how Congress has basically asked them that question. Are these something, you know, are they from an adversary? Is this a threat? I don't think those words were expressed specifically, but I mean, that would be the congressional concern. Is this a threat or not? We're seeing it in the newspapers. We're seeing it online. And you need to report back to us as to whether it's a threat or not. Certainly within the intelligence committees, they'll see more detail than we will. But, that's the response that's got to come. So one of the things I would say, looking at this historically, one of the advantages we still have is we still have benchmarks. We still have benchmarks in some of the incidents that we've talked about earlier in this discussion. You know, it's not like this is a new question.
Right.
This is a question that was always asked. In 1947, the question was, are the UFOs new technology? Are they German technology? Are they German technology the Russians have developed? Or is it something totally anomalous? You know, that's always been the question. Nobody, in all honesty, wants to necessarily That's our question. Let's put it that way. The way we've discussed it, that's the public question. That's the scientific question. The military question is, are they a threat?
Exactly. And again, that seems to remain the question right now. But fortunately, when we look at history, we can say one thing, that there has never been any overt threat in the long term that appears to have emerged from the study of these things. And again, that's one reason I think it is so important. If we're going to analyze this from an intelligence perspective, we must also know the history. And I hope, sincerely, maybe more than those in the media and some newcomers to this topic and their interest in it, I hope more so that the UAP Task Force and other government study groups, however many or whatever form they may take, that there may be, I hope that they also are looking at the history of this too. Larry, it's been a great time talking with you. I also wanted to ask in conclusion, what have you got cooking? What is next for you? Any books, any projects? What have you got going on?
Sure. At this point, I'm working in two projects, both with other SCU members. These are very rigorous, so they're long-term projects. They're nothing that you're going to accomplish in a year or probably 2 or 3 years, trying to put them in the correct context for scientific study and establish control groups and configure them so that at a point you can do some statistical analysis and come up with the levels of proof that you might expect. All of this is built around, the work that's in Unidentified was built around what's called strategic intelligence. Strategic intelligence was something developed during the Cold War when it became clear that you could never have as much information as you needed to be absolutely certain of something happening. It's a technique that's used to collect data, assess data, look for patterns, and provide an analysis that says, this is likely. We can't guarantee you it's going to happen, but there appears to either be a threat here, not a threat here. This is a very well-developed practice, and that's something that I did in the book Unidentified, as you've seen. I've moved on now to something hopefully more statistically viable, and we have two projects going. One I'm doing with Robert Powell, and we're doing a characteristic study. We've looked at several thousand very high-quality close encounter, and I mean close encounter in that the observation was close enough, within a mile, so that the observer could identify the object and describe it in three dimensions, get a very concrete feel as to its appearance, speed. You know, this is something close up that can be well defined, and we're capturing a considerable amount of information about the location, shape, size, speeds, characteristics, side effects, to see if what we can do in the way of profiling UAPs and seeing if UAP activities, appearance and activity changes over time. So that's one project, characteristic study. The other project is an intention study, which leans back to the atomic warfare complex and really raises the question of whether or not incidents at the atomic war complex sites were statistically significant. Was there something going on there that's not seen in the overall body of data? When you compare it to different geographic regions, different locations, a question of anomalous patterns. And to properly approach it, you don't assume there was, of course. You just look at those sites and you look at the controls and you draw your conclusion. But there's a lot of sites to look at and a lot of data to collect. And since you have to have multiple controls for each site, that's even more data to collect and analyze. So that's my second project. And those two should be enough to kind of take me far longer than I may have to go.
Well, it just goes to show how much work there is yet to be done with regard to this subject. And it's not all the flashy stuff we see on television. It really requires perseverance, a lot of time, a lot of dedication. That's one more reason I'm so glad that guys like you, Robert Powell, and Rich, and so many other folks who are involved with the SCU are doing what you're doing. So, again, Larry, I can't thank you enough for being my guest this week, and I certainly hope that we will have future conversations like this. In fact, I know we will.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it.
Well, indeed, the enjoyment has been mine, and I sincerely thank you, Larry Hancock, for being my guest this week and bringing your insights on this subject and, of course, your depth of historical knowledge to the conversation. And, of course, as always, there will be much more for ex-subscribers, which you don't want to miss out on. But that, of course, wraps it up for this week's edition of the program. Thanks again to Larry Hancock and to the SCU. And as always, this show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks. And other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. And I remain yours truly, Micah Hanks. On behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.